You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This is the Armchair Cricket Podcast.
Hello all. Welcome to another episode of Armchair Cricket Podcast, a podcast focusing on test cricket by armchair critics of the game. I'm your host, Ajit. In today's episode, we have the pleasure of Messi. Messi Jess joining us from Guerrilla Cricket fame. Hello, Messi.
Hello, Ajit. Good to be with you.
Fantastic to have you as always. I think you were also present not so long ago. And well, let's start with how are you doing and how's probably the end of summer right there?
It is. I've got to tell you, it's a huge relief. We had the hottest February imaginable, 11 days over 40 degrees, and all of a sudden the weather broke. This is in Perth.
Yeah.
And it's been beautiful the last couple of weeks. Meanwhile, in Melbourne, in March, which is supposedly autumn, they're in the middle of a heat wave. So, you know, it's just crazy weather everywhere.
Yeah, I mean, I was in India in February, and it was unseasonally hot. I mean, it was not yet the beginning of spring. Spring was about to enter and it was crazy. So I don't know what summer will be like there. So, well, we may have done some bad things to the weather, but I think we'll talk about it another time and, you know, on another podcast maybe.
Indeed.
But in this podcast, well, cricket will go on. We'll find ways to cover our pitches, cover our roofs and we'll play cricket, right? So first of all, let's go on to the England tour of India. So the last test, the fifth test, Dharamshala, happened between the last episode and now. First of all, does the result 4-1 surprise you, Messi?
It doesn't. It doesn't surprise me at all. Possibly the one does. because I think, I mean, England were, to put it bluntly, a shit show in that final test match. And I've heard them referred to as tired. They've only played something like 20 days of cricket. And it's test cricket. That's what you do. You're supposed to keep playing it. So I think maybe they were mentally very tired because at the end of the day, I don't think they're a very good team. And I don't actually have an issue with the whole Bazball thing, whatever that is, because I think the attitudinal issue in terms of giving people the courage, the license to do what they can do in a way that they felt afraid of doing previously has been wonderful for cricket, particularly for English cricket. I think there's been bits of it going on elsewhere that don't need to credit England for. It's just happened elsewhere anyhow. But
yes,
I think it's been good. But at the end of the day, particularly losing Leach and Brook early on, That England team was pretty mediocre. The young spinners did pretty well in the circumstances of not having experience, I thought.
Mm-hmm.
But the batting lineup was Crawley did well. There was a good innings each from Root and from Pope and from Duckett. Each of them had one good innings, but that's not going to get you through. Stokes was a shambles. Best, was a shambles. Folks, I thought, actually did reasonably well in the circumstances he was in.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a team that's capable of touring outside of England.
Mm-hmm.
I think they're well set to play in English conditions, but not overseas, not as they stand, anyhow.
Right.
They'll probably be triumphant in England this summer against the West Indies and Sri Lanka, and think it's all okay. But then they're going to go to New Zealand and Pakistan, and you know, the wheels might fall off again. I don't know, but I do think that it's interesting to note that the two tests series that they've had against England and India that are comparable to when Root was captain, the results are pretty much identical. And that's not to say I think Root should be captain again in any way, but I think there's been so much talk that's been overhyping England that it's led to totally unrealistic expectations in terms of what they can actually do. And India, on the other side, were brilliant. I thought they seemed rusty in the first test, to be honest.
Right.
But they really got their shit together and played some superb cricket with wonderful discoveries of Jaiswal. I think Safraz started really well, and I think he'll prove to be a real find as time goes on. So I think, the wicketkeeper as well.
Dhruv Chora.
Sorry. Yes. He proved to be a real find as well. So the depth of Indian cricket, like when they won that first tour of Australia when they were basically a B team.
Or a C team or whatever. Yeah.
Yes, it shows how strong the depth of Indian cricket really is, and that they are a force to be reckoned with, well, for the next decade at least, I suspect. Probably longer.
As long as it's not the finals of a tournament, I think we'll be okay. All right. So coming back to the tournament or the series itself, look, the last test, you could sense a bit of the, you know, last testitis or whatever, right? Let's go home itis. But, well, at least the way they started, the first half of the first day belonged to England, and they were right where they wanted India. I mean, 137 for two, Zach Crawley batting on 79, you know. You had it all, and that could have been 400, 500, and that would have been a different test. But
Yes.
It didn't happen.
Then, and they played some dreadful shots. They really did.
Hmm.
I mean,
I thought Bairstow, way too much aggression. It was not tempered with any kind of common sense almost.
Yeah.
It's a harsh thing to talk about. But when you have, I don't know, 29 out of 17 balls or something, you can always see a couple of balls off rather than going after every ball, which is pretty much what Bairstow did. But then somebody like Kuldeep or Ashwin will work you out. And Kuldeep was in the middle of a gem of a spell, I thought. The way they winkled out Root, Jadeja did that. But between them, the two left-arm spinners basically sunk England. The top six, seven fell to the left-arm spinners, of which Kuldeep took five. Right, and Jadeja worked out Root. I think Root was the one guy who was worked out. Crawley gave his wicket away. Mostly everybody else did. Maybe Ollie Pope walked past one, not expecting it to be a googly. Because I don't think anybody in that England top order picked Kuldeep's googly from his wrist.
I don't think at all. I thought Kuldeep bowled beautifully. I thought Ashwin bowled beautifully in the second innings.
Absolutely. Also in the first innings.
And Bumrah, yeah, I think Bumrah was very unlucky not to do better in the first innings, but the second innings, he got some just rewards.
Absolutely.
And he is so easily the best fast bowler in that series, probably in the world. I mean, he's got some competition from Cummins, I suppose, but he's a different sort of bowler to Cummins. I just love watching him bowl. He's brilliant.
Absolutely. Look, this guy is probably at the peak of his powers. I mean, I always say maybe he has another 15 tests left. But I'm revising it again to say he has 15 more tests left. So it's about how you manage him and his body. I think he was given a break timely. And with that, if you can get him through the next World Test Championship cycle, that'll be fantastic for India. Because the way he bowls, his action, I mean, it's not particularly good on anybody's body, I guess. And he's holding up as well as he can. But that's the difference, right? What he did in that second test, if you remember, how he brought India back. Those are the sort of spells that will stay with you forever. I mean, we actually heard it in Ashwin's podcast or Ashwin's review, where he had reviewed the first two games and he said how they managed to come back, because they felt England were actually very confident up to a point of being overconfident. That's what allowed India back into the series at 1-1, he said. And it was purely down to the genius of Bumrah, the way he dismissed all the pop and all that, right? And he continues to do that when it's required. Irrespective of the sort of pitches India play on, be it South Africa, be it India, doesn't matter. He delivers. And that is a fantastic thing.
Yes. I think Bumrah was also responsible for the wicket of the series, in my view. When he bowled Ollie Pope.
Oh, that one. Two stumps flying.
Yorker in the second test.
Yeah.
That sort of was indicative of where things were going to go from there on.
Yes.
England were, I think, 135 for three or something at the time.
Right.
And in a position where they could have gone on to make a big score and didn't. But that ball that yorked Pope, Pope barely made a run after that.
Right.
In the whole series. It destroyed him, I think.
I mean, that was one of the questions I was going to come to. If we can park it for a second and run through this test. So India batted really well, batted out 125 overs a day and a half or so on. Minimum what you were required to do in the first innings of a test. A couple of hundreds, Rohit and Shubman Gill sort of already making sure, you know, in the top two or three, they take the pressure out. They already eclipse England's total, right? And then let the rest of the rest of the order build. And that's what they did. Padikkal came to the party. I thought both between him and Sarfraz, they had 100 each as well, if they chose to. And somehow I was a bit disappointed they couldn't get it. Jadeja, Dhruv Jural had to fail, no big deal. But I felt very refreshed to see the way Kuldeep applied himself in two consecutive tests. He took time, he batted well, and Bumrah supported him. And between them, I think they batted close to like 25, 27 overs themselves. That was quite something. Right, and added to a lot of pain to England, who would probably expect, you know, at the end of second day, they were thought of already batting again. Maybe, you know, having already considered a huge lead. If the lead was already close to 200, it was a big deal. Now the lead grew to beyond 250, sort of decisive for me. From there, there's no comeback. They did it once in the series. No, the first test was very, 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 very amazing simply because of that innings by Ollie Pope. I thought that was one of the innings of the series, if anything.
Yes,
and
yes.
To win a test single-handedly. So Ashwin rightly, you know, in his podcast, he compares that to that innings by, I think, Chandimal. Chandimal or Dhananjay De Silva, I remember. One of those two, they played a third innings 160, a blinder. That defeated India and Sri Lanka once. And this is similar sort of a innings. I mean, once in a decade sort of an innings, I would say. But done to him.
That's right. I think it takes something like that for a visiting team to win in India.
Right.
Like Root's innings in the first test in the previous series.
Correct. At the double hundred, wasn't it? Huge, huge, amazing innings.
Yes.
So solid, solid innings again. But coming back to the third innings, well, only Root found the fight. Again, Bairstow was going well until Kuldeep got one to turn sharply and beat his defense. Again, he could have done with a little bit more caution mixed with that aggression that he has. One of the beneficiaries of this new thought process, no doubt, but between him and Crawley, you can also see they are the people that England look to when the chips are down, right? You would expect the Joe Root so comfortably entrenched at one end. You play for yourself. You say, let me get 100 here. I mean, we might lose the series. We might lose the test. I don't care. Let me get 100 here. Right. So that would have been nice if he would have replicated it. But, you know, talking of England's batting, what's going on with Stokes? 170 in the series. And he looked like a walking wicket in the last two tests.
He did.
Didn't last 10 balls each innings. What's going on there?
I just don't think his style is very well suited to Indian wickets. And I think his confidence was shot, particularly when it came to dealing with spinners. But it has to be said that twice in the series he did get out to absolute grubbers that he had no chance for.
Yes.
And he was unfortunate in that regard. But his you know, if he wasn't the captain, you would have said that man's got to be dropped because he's done bugger all for us.
It's not just about doing it. He didn't look like he wanted to be there. I mean, that's the point. Somebody who's played 100 plus tests, you have to eke out maybe 100 ball 28 at some point in time, if that's what your team needs, right? Maybe in this mindset, there is no thought process of such a innings at all in the England camp. But sometimes that's what you need, because for a person like Stokes, even if he gets to 28 of 100 balls, in the next 50 balls, he can probably make up 100 runs. He has the strokes. He knows it, right?
Yep.
So that's what was missing. So again...
Well, I mean, he did. He put up some fight till the end of the third test match. I mean, he made 41 and 15 in the third test. His last four innings were 3, 4, 0 and 2.
Yeah, that's what I meant. Not particularly great if you are the captain of a touring team. And, well, your ship might be sinking, but you're supposed to hold up, you know, that fighting spirit. Third innings, we really can't blame anybody else. I mean, they all went down in a heap. Hartley and Bashir, if you were to look at them as spinners now, first of all, happy with Bashir's favor?
Sorry, can I just go back to the England innings?
Hmm.
Ollie Pope getting stumped just before lunch.
Oh, yeah.
Going down the wicket to Kuldeep.
Walking past Googly. Yeah.
Yeah. And he didn't just walk past it. He walked to the leg side, so he couldn't even reach it. And it was indicative of his head being completely out of the space it needed to be in. And I think that was shown by the whole of the rest of the English batting for the rest of the game. I really do. Apart from Joe Root in the second innings, I thought that their batting was atrocious from then on. It really was.
Right.
They had no clue what they wanted to do.
I mean, it was surprising. It was unfortunate as well. But I expected a bit more fight from the likes of... you know, Folks can give you time. He really can't make a whole lot of fast runs. So it had to be like Bairstow or Stokes, right? Hartley did his bit, I thought. He, when possible, hit the ball far, right? I mean, Shoaib Bashir hung around. He did well. But he's not yet having those strokes, I think. But in time, you may see him also having those a little bit of bold strokes that you would ally with that sort of patience, right? In both the innings, he made some useful teens, Bashir. And Hartley made a 20 in the second innings. But, well, by then the game was sunk.
Yeah.
In this case, what do we make of the two as spinners? So Bashir took a 5-4. You would be happy with that sort of development?
Yeah, I mean, a young, inexperienced spinner, I thought he did very well in the circumstances. But the truth is that England left themselves in a situation where they didn't have anybody who could dry up the opposition. I mean, one of the beauties of, say, Australia's setup is that with Lyon at one end, he can hold up an end and not cost runs while the fast bowler getting a go at the other end. And, you know, Stark in particular can be quite expensive. But if Lyon is going for a couple of runs and over and keeping them under control, you can afford to do that. And it's one of the reasons Lyon gets wickets, because of that capacity to control the scoring. It frustrates batsmen and they take risks. There was the only risks that India took against Bashir were when there was, you know, if they got out, it didn't really matter that much. I think he shows an awful lot of promise. And if he gets the experience, I think he has the capacity to become a very good spin bowler. And I think more so than Hartley, in my view. I actually think he's more promising than Hartley, even though Hartley did so well early on.
All right. Hartley is a steady spinner, I think, when it comes to at least bowling. Yeah. But overall, as a package, you'd still want him in a, you know, South Asia tour. But I don't see both of them playing for England anywhere, not even in Surrey, not even at the Oval. Right? So that's a bit much. So, I mean, they have their own battles. We read that they'll find it tough that they themselves be included in their county sides and so on. So that's another discussion altogether. But coming back to the... So spinners of England, see, something that Ashwin said on his podcast or on his review stuck with me. He said, this bash ball is about not having a defense. It's about going attack, all the time. But if you're a spinner, that doesn't work. You highlighted it beautifully with what Lyon brings to the table, right? I mean, if you cannot bowl dry, if you cannot bowl defensively for a small period, you're not making that window possible for somebody to attack from the other end, right?
That's right.
And he doesn't have the experience yet, Shoaib Bashir, or for that matter, Hartley. And that was what you said, right? If you have considered 150 plus runs, it doesn't matter if you have taken 5 wickets because you would have bowled 45, 50 overs. And by then, that means the opposition is already far enough ahead, right? That's right. Between them, in this first innings of the fifth test, Hartley and Bashir bowled, 86 overs, 85, 86 overs. And if you have already conceded about, close to 300 runs in those 86 overs, it doesn't matter that you took 7 wickets between them. It's also about bowling dry. If you are... If your economy rate is above 3.5, you're not able to do the same damage if your economy rate is around 2.1, 2.2, right?
That's exactly right.
So that was the one thing that stuck with me. Maybe something England will also look at.
Well, I would argue that actually the same applies to the batters.
Okay.
As I see it, the England batting lineup at the moment has three batters who are capable of playing in a non-super aggressive mode. That's Root, Folks, who we spoke about earlier, and ironically Stokes. Stokes has the capacity to stay there for a long time without making a lot of runs and then taking off when he needs to. And to me, it's going to be a good indication of whether England are serious about being a good test team as to whether they keep Folks in, because Folks provides that capacity for other people to do stuff around him while he just stays there and makes runs, but not at the rate they would otherwise. If they take him out of there and go for another attacking batsman, I've heard talk of, is it Will Jacks who keeps wickets as well?
Really? I thought Will Jacks was a spinner.
Is it? Sorry, it's not Will Jacks. Somebody else. I'm not really over English.
Pope can keep, Bairstow can keep, and I'm hoping neither of them is made a keeper, even in England.
I mean, if Brook comes back in and they put Bairstow behind the stumps, then my view is that they'll certainly be a better team for having Brook back, but they still deny themselves the opportunity of having that mixture, and that it's just too high risk. If you want to be a seriously good team, you've got to have that balance. You can't all go hell for leather the whole time because there's too much risk involved. It's the same as for the spinners.
Right. No, I agree. I agree with you. And probably we'll see this evolution of this bash ball theory a little bit, where they also mix in enough caution along with that all-out aggression. But we can't really close the series out without talking about a certain James Anderson, who got to 700 wickets, the first ever fast bowler, and probably the first in quite a while, I suppose, who might get there, right? He's played 180-plus tests. We might not see fast bowlers play that many tests.
187, yes.
Exactly, right? So 87 tests would be great for a fast bowler. You can trim the 100 off, and that's already quite something, isn't it? I mean, Steyn, people like that played hardly 80-odd tests, right? Hardly. Right, even some of the greats, Akram.
There are only six players currently playing cricket who have played more than 100 tests.
Absolutely.
There are four who have played exactly 100, but there are only six currently who have played more than 100. So 187 is a huge number.
Absolutely. I mean, there's only one guy who's played more tests than Anderson currently, and that's Tendulkar.
Yeah. Well, I mean, he could overtake Sachin. It's always possible.
You see him playing in 2 years' time? That's quite something.
I don't know. I mean, he's fit, but the thing that struck me about Anderson was I thought for the first three tests, he was England's best bowler. I think he was starting to show some... Well, by the time we got to the fifth test, he didn't seem threatening, and especially with Bumrah back, the contrast was significant. But then, Wood didn't do anything either. I still think he's England's best fast bowler, without a doubt. So, Absolutely. Yes, he should be there. And as long as he's fit and he wants to play, they should let him keep playing. But I think they may need to manage him a little more because I think inevitably he's going to feel the pace a bit. You know, they've got a lot of tests coming up over the next 12 months. England, I think 13, something like that.
Okay, if he plays every one of them, he'll get 200.
That's right. That's right. He'll get to 200 overseas somewhere, I think, yeah.
I don't think he'll play every test because well, he has to also be preserved a little, right? And I think if there are dead rubbers or if there are places that are not conducive to his style of bowling, he can be rested. That's how it should be. That's all. But great cricketer. And we are actually lucky. I probably every era mentioned this, but we are very lucky to have this bunch of cricketers who are playing. Some genuine greats that we notice playing. And long may his career continue. That's all I can say.
Yeah. Well, the other person we need to mention is Jaiswal.
Yes.
I mean, he was just a revelation in this series.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a bit of a tie, I think, between him and Pope for the innings of the series.
Oh, yeah? Okay.
Because I thought his double 100 was so decisive, and he just was consistent through the series. He easily scored the most runs of anybody in the series. And to do that when, particularly when Rohit wasn't firing too well early on.
Correct.
Was absolutely vital for India. So that's fantastic. Given that Kohli's obviously going to come straight back into the team when he's available, I think KL Rahul's going to be pushing to find a spot in the team again.
Makes sense, yeah.
So it's going to be interesting. Even Padukal did well in the final test too. So it's great for India. They've got that talent coming through.
Absolutely.
And the capacity to be able to do that.
Look, it's nice if you're only thinking of purely Indian cricket, the depth that was on offer and people making the most of it. Well, not everyone, but let's just say Patidar couldn't make the most out of it. He was a bit unlucky, a bit timid at times, I thought, but maybe his time will come again. But what we have seen of Padukal and all of these other youngsters. So for me, one of the things that was really heartening to see the substance that Shubman Gill was able to find as well.
Yes, yes. Because there was a question mark over him for a while, wasn't there?
Correct. This was the series. This is the future of Indian batting between Padukal, Gill, Sarfraz. You'll probably, and Jural, right? You'll probably see the middle order of next generation of Indian test batting taking shape. And you can take a lot of heart from that. So that was also very nice for me. So, well, all in all, India would be very happy that in spite of having, almost 18 players in the series, they were able to walk away 4-1. So that's wonderful.
The only question, Mike, I would ask, I would have over India is the depth of their fast bowling. I mean, Jasprit Bumrah is head and shoulders above the rest of them. But when they're overseas, and say they're in Australia next year, the backup fast bowlers, you just wonder a bit about that depth.
Correct. I mean, Siraj had one impactful bowling innings. Akash Deep on debut did all right. In fact, good, I would say. But you would have to see if somebody else from the fast bowling lineup can come up with the similar sort of performance that Bumrah did. The one that can sort of shape the series or suddenly snatch the momentum in the middle of such an important period, right? So that is something you would want to see. Also, there are a couple of people injured, right? So Shami is injured, we know. Prasidh Krishna is injured, we know. So it remains to be seen if they're also able to make as good a comeback as we expect. Because Shami is the real second innings bowler and he was not on display at all in the series. So that would be quite something. We will see if that really comes up, especially when touring abroad, what you said, right? In the SENA countries, that will really make some difference.
Yes.
Now, moving on from here to the other test series that ended. I think you have to be able to probably give us some insight onto what sort of domination that Australia have over New Zealand. This is a mental one, I'm sure.
There's clearly a mental element. Mm. I mean, they haven't won a test match against Australia in New Zealand since, I think it's 1987 or something like that.
When Hadley was playing or whatever, the Hadley brothers were playing. Yeah.
It's really extraordinary, given the fact that they were world test champions just 3 years ago. It doesn't make sense. They dropped a lot of really important catches.
Yeah.
Williamson running himself out in the first test dear. Was, I mean, that was just nuts.
Schoolboy stuff.
It was. And somehow or other, I think that the desperation to win is actually undermining them. Australia were really lucky to get out of that. Because the truth is that for all that Australia won both test matches,
right?
It's sort of papering over the cracks in their top batting order.
Absolutely.
very dicey at the moment, in my view. There's unlikely to be a change in the personnel at all for the first test in Brisbane against India in November. But if they're in their current form, then I think they're going to be really up against it in terms of the Indian bowling attack. So they've been bailed out by the lower order to a large extent. And, I mean, the big positive for Australia was Cameron Green hitting that 160-odd, 170, was it?
Yeah.
In the first test.
Yeah.
I mean, what he did there was show that the selectors were dead right to make sure that they found a space for him in the team, because it was a very mature innings. He started relatively slowly.
Correct.
And went through the gears, and he got quite aggressive towards the end when he was running out of partners. But he's done that in the Sheffield Shield a lot of times. I noticed one of the New Zealand commentators said, oh, he's just finding his feet in first-class cricket. He's not. He's been playing first-class cricket for 5 years. Mm. He's been hitting centuries for Western Australia in Sheffield Shield cricket consistently. Right. And he is a run machine. The fact that he can bowl at 140 Ks as well is a huge bonus. But at the end of the day, his key role is to be that number four. And he has the capacity to be there for a decade if he can maintain that confidence in himself,
right.
And he'll take over as being the heart of Australia's middle order. But that being said, Smith and Khawaja, in my view, it's very different for Australia. Australia's been so used to having Warner in an attacking role as an opener,
right?
That having two people who are basically playing fairly stodgily at the beginning is it feels unnatural to me, because it also means you don't get a lot of the runs on the board in the first session, even if they're not out. And I think that puts Australia behind the eight ball, even if Smith does survive. But he's been looking very ropey. Khawaja's he's scored runs right over the summer, but he's not looking fantastic. And he's getting on. I mean, he's, I think, 36 now.
Correct.
So he's not going to be around for too long.
Mm-hmm.
Head seems to be going through a bad patch.
Right.
Mitchell Marsh has had a great time ever since he scored that century in the third test against England.
Mm-hmm.
But even he had three dud innings before he scored his 80 in the second innings of the second test match, which was a really key innings.
Right.
If it hadn't been for that, Australia wouldn't have had a chance of winning.
Mm-hmm.
And Carey coming good was really important for them,
because
he'd also been under a bit of a cloud. So there's a lot of question marks over them, whether they can, they have had a long, long period. Ever since the World Test Championship, or indeed the IPL before that for a lot of them.
Right.
So the last 12 or 15 months has been a long slog. And I think it will be good for people like Smith and Labuschagne not to be playing at the highest level. I think Labuschagne will probably go and play for Glamorgan again. I don't know if Smith's going to play for Sussex. But it may be they'll get back into the space of enjoying their cricket again rather than grinding it.
Right.
And I think that's really important.
It might not be a bad idea at all that they, you know, as you say, lose a little bit of that focus, that pressure of being under the scrutiny at all times. They go one level lower. Maybe they enjoy their cricket again and they come back. I'm sure people like Smith will be having stood up for the challenge, I'm sure he'll not let himself or the team down in the coming season. That's what I'm expecting. This is a sort of a, you know, this is sort of a start season, and you can expect that next one will not be easy if you're an opponent. But coming back to New Zealand.
Well, I think they suffered from a couple of things that were glaringly obvious. Mm-hmm. The first is I don't think they picked the right team.
Right.
To leave Santner out of both tests, so they didn't have a specialist spinner, was just madness. Kugelhoorn was, I mean, he did end up making some runs for them in the second test, but he was basically useless. He bowled, you know, very few overs. He looked dreadful.
Right.
And, you know, it was like having a trundle come in. So that was a space that could have well been taken by a Santner or Wagner, of course. Wagner would have been much better than Kugelhoorn either way. But they decided that they were moving on from Wagner. The other thing that combined with that, though, is I thought Tim Southee's captaincy was really ordinary.
Right.
There were some clear cases where he didn't use the matchups. For instance, when Marsh and Carey were putting on that partnership of whatever it was, 160 in the second innings in Christchurch.
Right.
He didn't bring spin on at all.
That was always questioned, yes. This is something that was questioned.
I mean, Carey had got out to spin previously very and looked all at sea. Marsh, dubious. But by the time they played themselves in, when he finally did bring spin on, it was fairly unthreatening to them. So I just thought and there was one farcical thing. He tried to get Kugelhoorn to bowl the short stuff that Wagner used to bowl, and Wagner was so good at it.
It takes a certain thought process to be able to do that.
It does.
Right.
But also physical capacity that Kugelhoorn hasn't got. And it was at a period, I don't know, Australia probably still needed 60 runs or so to win. So runs were an absolute premium.
Right.
He bowled one over where there was not a single run off the bat, but there were 12 extras.
Oh, dear. No. Yeah.
Five wides, four leg byes or maybe some buys as well. It was just all over the place. It was totally non-threatening to, I think it was Marsh who was facing. And it was just a complete waste of time. It was really, really poorly thought out. So I think strategically, New Zealand were just not doing their homework and not well captained on the field. So that didn't help. There was some good innings, but I don't know that... There's something got in their head, you know.
Yeah.
Darryl Mitchell and Rachin Ravindra did pretty well in their second innings.
Right.
Williamson made 50 before being bowled by Cummins. But there was so much more out there. They could have scored another 50 or 100 runs without
absolutely
a huge amount of effort, in my view. And the tail suddenly fell in a heap. And he thought, They've given Australia a look in.
Absolutely.
And they never really put the pressure on. You know, when Australia were, what was it, 34 for 4 and then 80 for 5.
That should have been game over, right?
It should have been. Yeah.
Most experienced teams kill the game off opposition at 150 all out or whatever. They should lose by 100 plus runs. Here again, you saw a little bit of resilience, the natural resilience that Australians bring to the game. But look, first point of yours, from 278 for 3, you have no business being a 372 all out in the third innings, the game-setting innings, right? You have to go on to 400, 500, right? That's the first thing.
Yep.
And the second thing, again, when you have the opposition, so at 80 for 5, with the top 5 dismissed, right? It's not like one of them is actually batting. The game is done, from what I know, right? The moment Head was dismissed, that's it. You cannot allow Mitch Marsh, Alex Carey. So I thought a bit of sameness in the thought process and in the field setting and so on, right? Ben Sears bowled well. He took two wickets multiple times. He brought
up. I thought Sears was their biggest positive from the series, actually. He's looking very promising as a bowler.
Absolutely. Will O'Rourke was also all right in the first test, I thought. I mean, they found good people to replace those that are retiring or have one foot out the door. But you probably rightly said off air, right? So it was not good enough. The captaincy of Saudi was a bit one-dimensional. Maybe he'll grow into the role, but maybe he won't. We don't know it yet. But it seemed very, very one-dimensional the way he was captaining. And from such a situation, even after the dismissal of Stark, 2/24/7, you require about 60, 70 runs. There is still a chance you can finish this game off. All you need are two or three good balls. Exactly at that stage, yep. though. Never came. There was never any pressure. But also, like, kudos to how Mitch Marsh played, right? And then Alex Carey. I think you're right when you say Alex Carey's was probably a breakthrough innings. His flagging international career was propped up immediately by those runs, I would say.
Well, that's the second highest ever score by a wicketkeeper in a successful chase.
Right. Wow.
The biggest one was Gilchrist in Hobart against Pakistan.
Another Australian, of course. All right.
Yeah. And then the third highest, I think, is Rishabh Pant. I can't remember.
87. That was. Oh, that game, that immortal 87. The one where he sort of...
That's right, in Brisbane.
Correct. Yeah. Correct. So, well, you can say this is all good, but you've actually hit the ball on the head when you say, you know, that... that when you have the ball rolling, when you have the things going your way, you have to convert them. You have to finish. You have to kill the game off. That's where
New
Zealand...
You have to catch your catches.
Oh, yeah. Oh. Saudi himself dropped a few. That was very strange.
Yeah.
Right?
Ravindra is a liability in the field.
Yet.
Absolutely. You just want to dig a hole and put him in it.
Oh, he's young yet. I mean, he has a lot to offer. But then, yeah, this is something you can't make a mistake on, especially against a team like Australia, who will definitely make sure you pay for it, right? So something to think of all of these things if you're New Zealand. But for me, it's the mental fear I think they have that they can't get out of. They can't get out of under Australia's thumb even while playing at home or away. I thought this, what I would consider pretty much the end of the golden generation of cricketers, New Zealand's current cricketers, Saudi. Yes. People like Williamson coming to the end of their career, Latham very well established, right? You have the next set coming up in terms of Blundell, Ravindra, even Phillips and so on, right? And Will O'Rourke and Sears and all of these people. It's nice to see, but then this golden generation will really feel let down by because they couldn't finish off in a series like this.
That's right.
You could have, you know, taken...
Well, there's a factor that we haven't mentioned, and that's Pat Cummings.
Okay.
I think the influence that Pat Cummins has on a game like that is immense because his captaincy of the Australian team is really sharp. He's grown in this job every series he's played, in my view.
Right.
And he has absolute loyalty from his team. But he's created in Australia a team that it bullies the opposition with their cricket, but not in that sort of nasty,
right.
Aggressive, personal way that it used to be, you know, but they can do it without being assholes. And then when it comes to the crunch, he is really able to apply himself with the bat like he did in Edgbaston against England. His very first test against South Africa, he hit the winning runs, in a partnership where they were chasing, and this one,
right?
You know, he and Carey put on 61 for the eighth wicket together.
Correct.
And you know, that's real leadership in my view.
Also, yes,
just being there and doing it, and setting an example without sort of crying about it. But
I mean, he was also there to score the runs.
The fact that we hadn't mentioned him till now is indicative of the fact that he's not someone there to sort of steal the limelight. He's just leading in a way that allows everybody to be able to do their thing. My judgment is that in many ways, his role as captain is more significant than Stokes's has been for England.
Very good. Very good comparison. I mean, I was about to bring it up myself. That's fantastic what you just say. And that's sort of very indicative. Both are inspiring captains. Both are sort of very influential cricketers as far as their own teams are concerned. But I think Cummins is able to do that much more, that much slightly more, that makes his team a ruthless one, right? Yeah. And that's what keeps Australia winning. And that's quite something.
And there's one other thing, of course. that bowling quartet.
Oh, yeah.
Hazelwood, Stark, Cummings and Lyon, who've now played, I think it's 18 tests together. This team hasn't changed over the summer at all.
Wow. Yeah, yeah.
And is likely to be the same team next time. But those four as a bowling group together are quite extraordinary as a team. And to have, you know, the luxury of Cameron Green and Mitchell Marsh there as well to just give a bit of relief from time to time. It's a really, really solid unit. And, I mean, they're fortunate that they should have at least a couple more years of that.
Absolutely.
So next Ashes, I think they'll still be in place. After that, there'll be a rebuild.
Correct. Look, you have what you said, right? Mitch Marsh stepping in correctly. Sort of, he's become a very mature cricketer these days. And yes. He stepped in with the bat, with the ball. You have sort of Cameron Green beginning to grow into the promise that we all saw. Head is always there. He's a little inconspicuous by his absence in this series, but that's okay.
Yes.
He does amazing, unbelievable things himself, right? And Smith and Labuschagne, you never write them off. So there's quite a lot yet to this Australian test team. And you can see them still being able to dominate international test cricket for a couple more seasons to come yet, as long as this... Yeah. Bowling attack can stay together, what you very rightly said. So,
although Nathan Lyon could still be going another 6 years away.
Well, it's nice to hear that. I somehow don't think he'll go that long. He will go long.
Don't be surprised if he goes back to England for the Ashes in another 3.5 years' time.
All right. We'll see if your prediction comes to fruition. That's quite something. I mean, English batsmen are already probably shaking in their boots, and the next generation of them will also start doing the same thing. Let's see if that comes to pass. Well, just to round out this topic, you know, Matt Henry's growth. Do we see this Matt Henry as the next leader of the attack? I mean, or is it just against Australia?
No. I think he has what it takes. He's bowled beautifully throughout this series. And he's... he's showing some maturity in his bowling. He was bowled into the ground in his first spell in the second innings of this test. And I think, again, Southee probably overdid it, using his weapon too long without giving him a break. So when he came back, he didn't quite have that same fire. But, you know, he's... I'm just looking him up now. He's taken, 95 wickets... in 25 tests, which is a fairly reasonable rate of return. And he's, so far in 2024, he's taken 20. So, yeah, in the last 3 years, 2022, he played three tests and took 16 wickets. Last year, he played four tests and took 19 wickets. This year he's played four tests and taken 23 wickets. Now, anytime you're averaging over 4 wickets per test, you're doing reasonably well. Every one of those years he's been well over that.
Right.
And so that's a pretty good indicator to me.
Well, fair enough. I mean, that's the one player I thought who might grow, and, you know, we will also see him quite a lot in the coming days. Now, also, another small news, Mitch Marsh has been sort of tipped to take over Australia's captaincy in the T20 World Cup. His growth is quite phenomenal in the last season or season and a half. Do you think he merits such a high post?
I do, for two reasons. I mean, it's probably not realised, because although he hasn't played that many test matches up until the third test against England,
right?
He's been in Australian touring parties a lot. And he is extremely well liked. I mean, everybody likes Mitch Marsh,
right?
Whether they're on his side or not, because he just has a lovely personality.
Yes, very unassuming, lovely lad by the looks of it.
Yeah. I mean, the speech he gave when he won the Alan Border Medal,
absolutely,
but it was him. It was very real. And I think he's like that in the dressing room. I mean, he's obviously fiercely determined to win,
right?
But not in such a way as to be an arsehole. And he's been the sort of beating heart of that dressing room, even when he hasn't been in the team a lot of the time.
Wow.
And he has, when he has led Australia in white ball games, he's had a pretty good record. He's learned a lot. I mean, he has captained Australia before, of course. He was the captain of the under 19 team when Australia won the under 19 World Cup.
Right.
Decade ago, I suppose.
Yeah, yeah.
And so he's got plenty of experience. And he's, yeah. I mean, it may be that Cummins stays on for one last World Cup.
Hmm.
But he'd be very relaxed about playing under Marsh. I've got no doubt. They're very, very right. close friends, I think, now.
That's good to hear.
Insofar as the captain can be with anybody on his team. And, yeah, I think he'd make an excellent captain in the white ball game.
Fantastic. Let's see if Australia are able to replicate the World Cup results under Marsh in the coming years. Now, going back, there are a couple of limited over series that we can have a quick chat about. One of them is the, well, we call it the Nagmani series, last episode, I think, out of fun. I think it was Sri Lanka's tour of Bangladesh. So we've reached the end of the T20s series where, you know, it was a one-all at the end of two games where Bangladesh struck back and took the second one quite comfortably. But in the third one, Sri Lanka showed their mettle. They won the game quite comfortably. You know, it was a high-scoring series overall. But having made 174, you thought Sri Lanka in a decider were sort of, you know, in a good position. And that's how it turned out because Bangladesh had a collapse at the start. And they couldn't get going at all. And it took the sort of the middle order, the all-rounders to prop them up. But by then, the horse had already bolted. They were not going to have enough balls to win the game. So, but, you know, a couple of very good performances. This is a T20 World Cup year after all. So every team will be looking at that. So first of all, from Captain Hasaranga, who's, when possible, promoted himself up the order. He even made Dhananjay De Silva open the batting. That's, I think, a fairly interesting thought process to include, the likes of Shanaka and Matthews both in the 11. You would always expect only one of them to play unless it's really Asian, South Asian conditions. But they both got to play. Somebody like Samara Vikrama was held back in the decider just to see if, you know, the big hitters can go ahead of him. He's sort of in position to stop a collapse, as it were. And that worked.
Yes.
And when it came to bowling, again, some fantastic, fantastic things. You saw somebody like Binura Fernando coming back, Nuwan Tushara taking a 5-4 in that decider. And Hasaranga himself might go for a few runs playing against South Asian countries, but he'll give you those 2 or 3 wickets every game. The most important thing, I thought.
One of the interesting things with the Bangladesh innings, although they were well beaten in that second T20, was the fact that the runs came from down the order.
I think in the third one, but yeah, you go on. You're right.
Oh, sorry, the third one. Yes.
Yes.
Sorry, you were talking about the second one, were you?
Second one, they won. Second one, they won comfortably, I think, Bangladesh. But the third one was where the series was decided because it was 1-1. And in the third one is when you saw those runs coming from Rishad Hossain, those people. I think that's what you mean.
Yes. Yes, that's right. Yeah.
But,
so it's interesting to see them having the capacity to find some runs down at the bottom of the order because they have been a bit vulnerable down there before. So it'll be interesting. There's a lot of niggle in this series.
Correct.
They still haven't forgotten the timed out in the World Cup.
Oh, no. Yeah, yeah. I think it was, who was it? I think it was Shanto, the captain of Bangladesh, who mentioned it casually in a press conference.
Yes.
It looks like they have actually not forgotten it. We still hear about it often enough. Right, yes. We don't know what all is being said away from the mics for sure. But I mean, come on, this is the now the India versus Pakistan of the South Asian world, I suppose.
Yes, yes.
Right. If,
yes.
Without you know, insulting any of these teams, it's quite something people look forward to, and the fans of both teams are very, very passionate, and that itself is a story within a story per se, right?
Well, it's good to at least see that Sri Lanka are organized enough to put together a team to tour at the moment.
Yes. I mean, look, there'll be a lot of talk of what needs to happen and boards need to change and everything. But when it comes to putting a team out there on the field, they'll never make a mistake with that, I think.
Yes. Yeah.
All right. From that series, which was fairly evenly contested, to another one, this is the Afghanistan-Ireland series, which is being played in UAE. So, again, Ireland surprised Afghanistan by winning the test. And then they also, you know, in the ODI series, it's well contested. because the first ODI, Afghanistan won by 35 runs. It was a, you know, sort of a stodgy sort of a wicket. Second one got rained off, surprisingly, in UAE, which can happen.
Yeah, you don't expect that, do you?
Yeah. it can happen that, you know, there's a lot of rain and Sharjah. Occasionally, these things happen. But the first one was a high-scoring affair that Afghanistan won quite comfortably. Gurbaz made a 100, a huge 100. And finally, most of the people in the top order stood up. They got to 310. And that was 30, 40 runs too many.
Yeah.
As far as Ireland was concerned. But Harry Tector made a 100 of his own. Lorcan Tucker, 85. They built up to a point where, I mean, they were fairly behind the required rate. But they bought Ireland to a point from which there was a challenge possible. That itself was a big deal. But when it came to the third of the games, well, it's currently underway and Afghanistan have made a slightly underwhelming total. So I don't know what you think of this, Messi. So Afghanistan are defending just 236. It's in similar conditions in Sharjah. And Ireland are at 11 for 1 in the fifth over.
Yeah, Gurbaz was looking good and then he got out to a very poor shot for 51.
Right.
It's been fairly patchy. The wicket doesn't look that easy, and Balbirnie being out for one's obviously a big thing.
Right.
I think though, given the fact that they're only chasing 237 to win, Ireland are in a reasonably good position. They can pace themselves on this wicket, and their batting lineup is, you know, it's quite significant these days.
Absolutely.
So I think there's a good chance of that series ending level. After all, the other thing about Ireland is that Cricket Ireland this week announced that they are, well, they're due for a series. I think it's against Sri Lanka, which is now going to be played in the UAE rather than in Ireland.
Wow.
And that they were due to play Australia in one T20 and three ODIs in Ireland in August.
Right.
Australia are then going on to England to play 7 white ball matches, I think.
Right.
They announced last week that they can't afford to put them on because of the cost of setting up temporary grandstands. They don't own any of the facilities in Ireland, so it's quite expensive. And it was going to cost them too much to be able to do it. Now, what struck me about that is if you can't host a white ball series, 3 games against the world champions, then who the hell can you do it against? Surely there is some money to be made there, both in terms of crowds and in terms of broadcasting rights.
Right.
And so they said, no, we can't do it. There may be another part to this agenda. There is a meeting of the ICC in Dubai this coming week.
I see. Okay.
Where it's likely to be raised. Ireland say that they don't have enough money, that they haven't got the full pot of $19 million that they were allocated because some was withheld. It may be a gambit to try and persuade the ICC to release some more funds for them to be able to do it. I don't know. But if it doesn't go ahead, that's a huge shame because what everybody had been suggesting was that Ireland was a great stop-off point for teams touring England to play a game or two on their way there to give them a chance. But, I mean, Ireland's in a real difficult place at the moment because there's no red ball cricket being played in Ireland at all at the moment.
Right.
So they're focusing everything on white ball cricket. And then if they can't play the world champions in ODIs, then what's the point? It's all a bit of a shit show, really.
Well, there are some problems that they'll want to overcome. And it's for the better of their cricket. Well, they won their first ever test just on this turf that we were discussing. And that must give them a lot of fillip. And yes, sometimes you have to be able to take a little bit of a loan to make some money for yourself and for your board as well, I suppose. It's a tough thing to do, but it's the right thing to do. Let's put it like this. So let's hope Irish cricket finds the depth and this the resolve that they need to carry on a little longer. I'm sure slightly healthier, financially healthier times are just on the corner as far as they're concerned.
Yeah, yeah.
And Afghanistan have a little bit underwhelmed in terms of results this season. But Trott has done
Yes,
well.
they
I
have.
think they are going through a tough period of sort of maturing. They've done
Well, they've
everything
been
pretty
missing
well.
Rashid.
Yes.
They've been missing Rashid Khan too, haven't they? Quite badly.
It's a good point. I mean, but it's not one player that will ever make a team, right? He might be the talismanic player, no doubt. They still have some good players in terms of Nabi, in terms of people like Gurbaz and all of these
Oh,
people, right?
yes.
Somebody like Rehmat Shah has been very quiet. Skipper himself, Shahidi, can do more. We know that. So there are all of these things to be had. And let's see if they can wake themselves up in time as well. And maybe, you know, make this a very thrilling contest, this game against Ireland right now.
Yeah. Well, Shahidi made 69 today, but only
yes.
made it at a stroke rate of 67.
There you go. Right?
Yeah.
Let's see if he's able to find that fast scoring rhythm. I think he's been a bit yo-yo up and down the order and those things. Let's see if they're able to break out of, you know, it's just one of those learning things. But Rashid Khan is set to return back to the team for the T20Is. So they're playing the ODIs after this, the T20Is start, and that'll be a welcome break. We still don't know anything about Mujib. But these two would be really talismanic when it comes to bowling and defending. If you see,
So does that mean Rashid's going to be playing the IPL as well, I presume?
I suppose he's back in time.
Yeah.
But it's a long long layoff he had. He had missed the BBL. He missed some tests. So, I mean, he's been playing nonstop pretty much, I suppose. And some toll had to go on his body. And finally, it broke down. It required him 4 or 5 months of break to sort of rebuild his body back. But let's hope his potency remains undiminished. Going on. There are some interesting off-field news that I thought we can discuss. So Hamilton Mazakatsa, who was the director of Zimbabwe cricket, has resigned from his position, stating that, you know, their inability to make the T20 World Cup this year was the main reason for him to step down.
It's strange, isn't it? Because they're co-hosts of the ODI World Cup in a couple of years' time, aren't
right.
they? So,
right.
I suppose if they're going to have a change, now's a good time to do it.
I suppose
so. They can build up to that.
There are 4 years left, and he himself had a 4-year tenure. And it was good, but not great, this tenure. And probably time for a slightly different direction. Nothing wrong there. And speaking of players, Noor Ali Zadran, Afghanistan's player, has retired from international cricket. So basically, he's played 2 tests, 51 ODIs, 23 T20Is. Not a lot to write home about.
No.
But, you know, sort of starting... teams, fortunes, and, you know, it's the same for every team, I suppose. Sri Lanka had it, Bangladesh had it. You have a bunch of players, batters, averaging in the mid-20s, but they're important for those huge 30s, 40s averaging players to come through. So he had that sort of a career, probably a bit underwhelming, you might say, given his versatility and given his talent, but that's all right. We wish Noor Ali Zadran all the best in the upcoming days.
Well, I suppose the other person that we haven't spoken about is Neil Wagner's retirement.
All right, yes.
Or have you dealt with that
previously?
We did,
but I would like your thoughts. I mean, in the previous episode, it was already clear he was going to retire, but I want to know your thoughts.
I think he was a huge servant to New Zealand cricket. I mean, if ever there was a bowler you can describe as a workhorse, it was him. He put everything into it.
Mm.
And I think... his capacity to just bowl short if necessary, he's the bowler can do it better than anybody else.
Right.
And keep it up. I mean, the effort that went into doing that must have been immense.
Right.
I've got a huge admiration for him. I'm hugely sad that I don't think New Zealand dealt with his departure very well at all.
No, I think Ross Taylor spoke about it, that maybe he may have been pushed a little. But yeah.
I was pleased when he came onto the field in Wellington as the 12th man.
Correct.
There was a massive cheer all around the ground for him. Which was...
No, he was very well liked. I mean, he may have had, you know, been a tough competitor, but he was a consummate professional. And that's
Absolutely.
Something you appreciate, even if you are an opponent, right?
Yeah.
So, and he finished with fourth on the list of number of wickets for New Zealand. And for somebody who moved away from his home of South Africa, made a second home in New Zealand, that's fantastic achievement. So, you can't wax lyrical enough about somebody who's a mace, you know, he's not a sword.
Yeah.
He's not the one that will deal you what you may call as a deadly blow, but he's one that will soften you up. And that's very important too.
Yes, absolutely.
Right.
He was a very important part of that team that got New Zealand to the World Cup final and their victory in the end.
Fair enough. we already wished him, but we would like to do that again. All the best for the rest of his life. Maybe he comes up in coaching setup, and maybe I can't see him quite sitting in a commentary box and talk about the game, but probably behind the scenes, getting more people like him ready, hardworking people, and giving them that that little bit of stubborn streak, right? Fast bowling.
Indeed. Yeah. Yeah.
So another interesting news, must say, is that, Jai Shah, during the last test India-England in that series, he announced a sizable amount of money, about 40 crores to be set aside for the test match promotion and test match, awarding those that did well in test matches in India. So something like people who play more than 50% of the games in a year will be entitled to a 30 lakh incentive. A lakh is 100,000. So that's not a small amount of money, 30 lakhs. And a non-play member will still get 15 lakhs per game. And if you play 75% of the tests, you'll be awarded 45 lakhs per game. So the number of games you play in the year will impact the amount you earn per game. That is quite something already.
Plus, there have increased payments for playing in the Ranji Trophy as well.
Absolutely.
They?
And Ranji Trophy is one of the more lucrative, when it comes to playing first-class cricket anywhere in the world, that's one of the most lucrative, and that's fantastic. So the focus is still remaining on the red ball game in India and even in the local setup, because now that you can see, people are encouraged to go back and play. In fact, they're ordered to go back and play for their domestic teams at whatever level they want, right? We discussed this a couple of episodes back. So yes. We saw Shreyas Iyer come back. He's playing in the final of the Ranji Trophy currently underway, where Mumbai are head and shoulders above Vidarbha and very much on the way to taking the trophy, must be said, because Vidarbha need a mere 538 runs to take the trophy in the fourth innings. They are 10 for no loss and there are two full days left of play. You would expect right. that Mumbai will take it. But in the second innings, you saw some very important performances. It was a low-scoring first innings set, but Mushir Khan, the brother of Sarfraz Khan, made 136. Ajinkya Rahane made 73 and Shreyas Iyer made 95. All very important innings in the top of that order to put the game sort of more or less beyond Vidarbha at this stage. I mean, barring a real miracle, you can't see them take this game. So Mumbai are more or less definitely the champions of Ranji Trophy for this season. Not a real surprise.
Well, I hope they get some extra money from the BCCI just to put into the facilities.
Exactly, that as well. They're going to look at different sort of pitches in different parts of India where if you want a fast bowling pitch, you can go practice there if you want.
I was talking about spectator facilities. I've seen some posts about the facilities for spectators during the final of the Ranji Trophy.
Fine.
And they're appalling. They've only opened the one stand.
Right.
And the toilets are appalling. It's a shambles and it really shouldn't be.
Fair enough.
With that sort of money available. Anyhow.
That's a good point. We also saw some posts during the World Cup itself that not every facility was up to the mark. Maybe there is something to be done here, right? And I hope the people who are making these decisions in the BCCI are listening and are, it shouldn't be an embarrassment, right? So
here's the thing. I'm hugely encouraged by the BCCI making that financial commitment to people playing red ball cricket so that, white ball isn't the only attraction for them.
Right.
And it's happening in Australia to a certain extent. I mean, for example, it's been made clear by Cricket Australia that Cameron Green will not be playing in the white ball team in the lead up to the series against India. He'll be playing Sheffield Shield cricket. And in England, the contract system is such that it is still very attractive for people to be contracted centrally and not have to go off around the world. I think all of those are really good in terms of commitments to red ball cricket. The problem, though, is that those are the only three countries that have the funds to be able to do that. And every other test playing nation is not in a position to pay their test players and their first class players anything like as much to make it attractive for them rather than going off, if they're very good,
right,
to play in white ball cricket elsewhere. And that's where the ICC has a huge role to play to somehow find a means by which players can be rewarded for staying in red ball cricket. And that may not actually involve paying the boards themselves. It may involve some form of distribution from a pool to the players rather than to the boards, so that there is a very, very direct incentive for them to do that. I don't know, but
it's an interesting thought process.
It's a great sign, but it's also one where the big three are in a position to do it, and nobody else is.
Correct.
And that's the worry.
Correct.
And so you widen the gap.
This is a problem. I think it's a very tough one. Even ICC will be probably pondering how to address it, because eventually it may come across to a point where five or six teams end up playing top level, top tier test match cricket while everyone else plays the white ball games. And we are trying to avoid that, surely, if you are ICC. So,
yeah, absolutely.
Now, the last topic I wanted to bring up today is the WPL, the Women's Premier League. It's very close to its, you know, decisive games. So, you have a Mumbai versus RCB game currently going on, where Mumbai were bundled out for 113. Your favorite, Elisa Perry, took a 6-4 with the ball, 6-15.
Six for 15, yes.
That's quite something.
And she's batting right now. Yes.
It's a tough chase, I mean, by the looks of it, right? Bangalore have the batting.
They're 49 for 3 after 8 overs. Correct. But, I think there's a... they're very likely to make it, which would mean if RCB do win this,
yes,
that they will. In fact, it's not going to make much difference to the table either way. It seems to me
it's about the top three finish, I suppose, so that you get if required, one more crack.
The Delhi Capitals and Mumbai Indians are both on 10 points with one game to play. Mumbai Indians look like losing this, which will leave the Delhi Capitals on top unless they lose by a huge margin the last one. So you'll like to see the Mumbai Indians playing RCB in the eliminator, and then the final between Delhi Capitals
and the winner
and one of those two.
Correct.
It's been interesting that the overseas players didn't make a huge mark early on, and as time's gone on, I think they've become more significant. You've seen players not just the overseas players, the star players really have really come into their own.
That would be a good assessment indeed.
Last week or so of it, and have really pulled out the stops to have some quite spectacular finishes over the last week or so. But I tell you what's great, to see big crowds, hugely enthusiastic, 20, 25, 30,000 watching. And you can bet that the finals will be packed out.
Absolutely.
And some great quality cricket. The fielding still leaves a bit to be desired, in my view. But I think the standard of the bowling and the batting has improved even since last year. So who was it? Was it Ismail who somebody bowled a ball that was clocked at 131 kilometers an hour?
It was Shabnam Ismail, yes. It was the fastest ball in women's cricket, it was touted to be.
I reckon that's fantastic.
Absolutely.
It just shows how much harder it's getting.
Well, that's all right. I mean, once with the right amount of, you know, facilities are available, the right same kind of guidance when it comes to maintaining the body and maintaining the fitness is made available, both the teams would, or both the sets of players, men and women, will go up and up in terms of every way possible. And then you'd see excellent excellent results there as well. Well, it's overall very encouraging for Indian women's cricket. By the way, I think one of the batters has just been dropped. It's not Elisa Perry, but her partner. That was a...
Yeah, Risha Ghosh was dropped by, I think it was Grace Harris. I'm not
no,
sure.
It's Natalie Sivert-Brunt, actually.
Oh, was it?
Yeah, it could be defining sort of a catch, because if she plays any amount of time, she'll go after the bowling hard.
And Ismail was bowling, and you don't want to drop off her bowling.
It looked, the look she gave was quite something to the fielder. All right, let's see. which one might win. I mean, Mumbai and Delhi are actually the favorites to make the final, but RCB women want to have a say. And God willing, the RCB women's team will win the first IPL or the first Premier League trophy. The men have been.
You've been a frustrated RCB supporter for a long time now, haven't you?
Absolutely.
Well, I've got to say, I was looking through the IPL teams yesterday, actually, and I do think the RCB team on paper looks pretty strong. So,
I mean,
for the IPL.
We don't talk about the RCB team's
chances. That won't be the first time.
Absolutely. We won't talk about the RCB team's chances until the last five games or last six games of the tournament remaining.
Yeah, because they can do RCB things. Mumbai Indians are still going to be really hard to beat in the IPL.
Yeah, let's see how that goes. And this Mumbai Indian women's team also have a lot of stars. RCB are making up good. Delhi is strong. So let's see how it plays out.
Indeed.
All right. Those were all the topics for this episode, Missy. Thanks once again. I know it's an ungodly hour where you are.
It's half past midnight here, yes.
There you go.
I'm used to it.
But thanks a lot for making this happen. And for your wonderful and forthright views, we always enjoy them.
My pleasure. Thank you very much, Ajit. And I look forward to coming back with you at some stage in the future.
Perfect. Thanks a lot. And so will all our listeners, I'm sure. We thank all our listeners. They are always with us, no matter who's our guest. And we hope to have them in the coming episodes as well. Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
This is the Armchair Cricket Podcast.
Podcast Network. Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.